house.
Hi, I'm Izzy, and this is When Someone Great Is Gone, the podcast about the relationship between grief and creative expression. If you haven't already listened to episode 1, 2, or 3, we recommend listening back from the start. Today's episode contains themes of death and grief, so it may not be suitable for all listeners. I'm not the best at playing piano in the world. I think my mum, Sue, once told me that I'm the jack of all trades, master of none when it comes to instruments. But I often find myself drawn to Kate's piano in my family home when I need a bit of time on my own or to feel reflective. Kate's piano was given to her as an apology gift during some sort of weird confrontation when she worked at the BBC. And I always love that anecdote because whenever I'm playing it, it makes me think of how it's been given to us as a family because of something she was involved with. So there's always the element of it being her piano and now ours. My brother's actually much better at the piano than me, but I quite like how scattered I play it.
Ah! Why have I forgotten that?
Sometimes I'll find myself in a quiet moment. It might be that I'm on my own in the house, or quite often it's in response to a piece of music I've just heard, especially one that relates to Kate, such as The Waterboys or R.E.M., Beethoven, The Beatles, the list is endless. And it'll probably be quite late. My mum Sue will have been asleep, or my brother Dan is here as well. He might be gaming in the living room. And I'll start to feel this nostalgic feeling, this emotion that's been sparked by something. It's like a wave. It builds up from inside your stomach and washes all over you. You feel it in every extension of your body, in every limb, in every finger, in every toe. And I struggle to articulate it even after years of trying. But it's in these moments that I will reach for a piano, or reach for a pen and paper, or just start to sing.
I think I have lots of different rituals.
In terms of ritual.
An act of ritual, I guess.
A ritual for me. Playing piano and writing words down.
We'd just drink a bottle of wine every night and cheers to our friend and how great he was. That's how we got through it. I have letters that she left us before she died. And my ritual is definitely that I get those letters out and I read them.
A rhythm with my writing. As soon as I wake up, I would grab my diary and write for a few pages.
Rituals in order to remember someone are really important, especially because the feelings that grief evokes are insistent. They never cease. They come in different forms, and sometimes it's a lot to deal with, and you just need something that isn't verbal to express yourself.
Hi, it's Bridie, one of the producers on this show, along with Izzy. As you might have guessed, this week we have become interested in the idea of ritual and the things that we do individually or collectively to remember somebody. And so one of the things that we did was just reach out to lots of different people in our lives and ask them to talk about rituals that they had. And we got some delightful, lovely responses that we're so glad people have shared with us, some of which you've already heard, many of which focus on kind of single acts of symbolism, like this story from my friend Ruby.
So my mum died in February. That time of year is when the crocuses come up. She always talked about wanting to be buried under a daffodil. And so things like crocuses, when they come up every year in the same place, they're so dependable, they're so beautiful, and they're very like hardy, and they come up right in the winter, and they're always up around the time of her like death anniversary. And so me and my flatmate went to Battersea Park, which is where it is near where I was born, and my mum used to take me there every day in my like pram. And we together we took this little tin of ashes and we sprinkled them around in the crocuses that were coming up there, and American tourists were watching us. I think they thought we were doing something like very British. It was very funny. To kind of bring a piece of my present in contact with like that past, in terms of it being somewhere that I'd been with my mum and the flowers, and it all felt very like, it was very symbolic.
Another thing that we kept finding, there would be this story someone would tell about an individual act of ritual and an individual act of grief that would then morph into somehow a collective act.
And I remember that I just kind of sat up all night, the night before her funeral, and I was just like writing, and I just got it all out, stood up and spoke it to the whole church, and that was quite a kind of out-of-body experience, really, but I'm glad that I did it.
And we started to hear stories of communities coming together and the way that the people around us, just being there, can support us through loss.
He died just at the time when I was getting more into poetry, so I started joining some poetry collectives, and I started a part of a poetry group and course. And so reading and sharing those pieces, and then having other people that were also reading very deeply personal pieces from grief and trauma that they had experienced, and a kind of different sense of community and a support that's different from, say, for example, if you're sitting down with a therapist or with a friend and specifically talking about what you've gone through.
And we heard that in loads of different ways. Like, here's Abbas, who's a doctor, who is dealing with a completely different kind of grief.
When a patient dies and you're looking after them, you always, maybe not always, but there are lots of times when you feel like you could have done more, and actually speaking to a colleague, you realise that actually you did everything you could, you did everything any doctor would have done, and actually a lot of it is just like accepting that you did your best and that you shouldn't dwell on it.
When it was Kate's 20th anniversary of her passing, we all went up to Highgate Cemetery and we all grieved in different ways. It's one of those places in London where the trees are really tall and green and the light shines just in the right way. And although it's kind of a tourist hotspot, which is quite a bizarre place for my mum to be buried, because there are figures such as Karl Marx who are buried there, what's so lovely about it is that it's so peaceful. So I remember just breaking down a bit by the grave in front of everyone and feeling quite uncomfortable with the fact that every time I'm in Highgate Cemetery, I get so emotional. And then I remember one of my aunties, Ria. She had her electric wheelchair and she sped down Highgate Cemetery's path amongst all this kind of wooded enclosure to get to Kate's grave. We were kind of shouting after her, like, be careful, slow down. And then she gets up to Kate's grave and she gives the grave a kiss and she says, hi, Katie. How are you doing? We miss you and we love you. And it's having that ritual and that absolute love as a collective group of our chosen family that makes it okay, that makes us feel all right. And it makes me so emotional because I will be forever in debt to that group of women for helping us when we most needed it and for making us feel like a family again when part of our family unfortunately went. We spoke to Anna and Louise from Life, Death, Whatever, about rituals, the community they've built around grief, and how they work with grief on a professional level.
I think the most important thing that anyone can do when someone is grieving is listen to them and be there. My name is Anna Lyons. I'm an end-of-life doula. End-of-life doulas work with people living with life-limiting illness, their friends and their family, and they work doing grief support after somebody's died. In the doula world, we describe it as bearing witness to their pain, hearing how somebody feels, acknowledging it, and being there regardless.
So my name's Louise Winter, and I'm a funeral director. Rituals are so important. They give a sense of meaning. They give some structure to a time that can feel really chaotic and really alien. When someone has died, everything is just thrown out. Our whole world changes overnight. Often, even if we have been expecting it, it can still feel totally alien and overwhelming. And I think by having rituals, we give a sense of order and structure to that. They're a way of getting us through something. When I first started working in the world of funerals, I was helping people to plan their funerals as a way of helping them work out who they are in life and how they can live a better life, and also making more empowered choices around funerals, armed with some actual information. And Anna was a guinea pig. So we met on Twitter. I was looking for people who wanted to plan their funeral.
My friend had just died very, very unexpectedly. And I'd just come back from America from his funeral. And it struck me that we have absolutely no idea what's going to happen today even, let alone tomorrow. And I wanted to sort of grab a bit of control, I guess.
We became friends and I spent lots of time around Anna's kitchen table discussing everything related to death and dying, and most importantly, how it relates to life and living.
Lots of people were working in death and lots of people were working at end of life, but they weren't bringing them together. And I think it's really, really important. You know, one doesn't really stop when the other begins and vice versa. Yeah, that was how it started.
We work together as life, death, whatever, providing a platform for people to come together to talk about grief, to talk about death, dying, funerals, and all aspects of love, life, and loss in many forms. We've run festivals, we've held many events, we have an Instagram profile, which is really popular, and we also run Five Things, which is where people share their experiences with us about what they've learned.
The first thing that we ever did was run the first ever family death cafe at Asylum in Peckham.
Through an extraordinary series of events, we ended up being offered a National Trust house for a whole month to run a festival about death and dying. So that really was where Life, Death, Whatever came about.
We're an online platform. We have art exhibitions and we create installations, and we did a voices project at Dulwich Picture Gallery in their chapel there, where people sent in streams of consciousness about what they've learnt, how they feel about life and death, what matters to them, what they've realised doesn't matter, about regret.
It's all just about helping people to engage with this subject, hopefully in a way which they find inspiring and informative, and possibly changes the way that they're living their lives.
We set out to redesign the dialogue around death and dying, to open it up, to make it a normal part of everyday conversation, to try to get everybody talking about it. It's much easier to have a conversation about what you want and what you need when you're well than when you're very unwell. We try to engage the wider community, people who wouldn't ordinarily be engaged in thinking about end of life and death and dying. We've tried to sort of bring death out of the shadows, and everything we do, we try to do it really beautifully and really accessibly. Because I think we're told that death is the last taboo constantly by the media. We're told that people don't talk about it or can't talk about it, and we think that that's just rubbish. We try to show that you can talk about it. It doesn't have to be the most difficult conversation.
This is Danny Martin, a spoken word artist who spoke to us about remembrance, community and rituals, and how he creatively expresses his grief through spoken word.
He supported Tottenham. Not me, though. I thought I knew better and I supported Arsenal. And we play football for our local team, five-a-side, on Monday nights, and I think, out of pride, not once can I recall him passing me the ball. He would never give me that sort of satisfaction, like a wrestling faction. We were just two feuding members of the same team. We used to spend every single night together at our local chicken shop, fighting over who gets to go first on the fruit machine. We had our own sets of morals, though. If one lost, the other one had to offer the chance to borrow. And how we rejoiced in each other's sorrow, £1 at a time. His smile drew wide as the fruit machine swallowed, until I said I'd had enough, and he just thought to himself, lovely stuff, and proceeded to put £1 in and take out the jackpot prize, buy the 2-for-2 chicken burger meal deal and not even share with me the fries. He seemed to win a lot more than me. See, we were the best of friends, but also the best of enemies. We used to know every single word to Mitchell Brothers Alone with the TV. But he got to recite two verses compared to the one of me. I didn't mind, though, because he rapped them so terribly and it would make me laugh. And then again, he wouldn't talk to me for a while. We were perfectly imperfect and perfectly juvenile. At 16, we did an all-nighter. 20 of us sharing about 2 litres worth of cider. There was him, me, earphone each from his MP3. We listened to Coldplay in a skate park in pitch dark, singing The Lights Will Guide Us Home. At 17, we discovered fake ID. Problem was, mine looked more like him and his looked more like me. But do you think we ever swapped to help each other out? Of course not, never in doubt. Routine of Oscar's bar before 7 p.m. An hour before the bouncers arrived and pretty much the same time as the barmen. We just wanted to get a feeling for the room. And that was our favourite 1 hour when it was just us two, even though we had 3 arguments after 4 beers about who's going to pay for the 5 cheap shots. But either way, the alcohol got consumed. And I'd be looking for him, but he'd be over talking to DJ Raj by the DJ booth, or outside with Phil the bouncer having a fag in his oversized parka jacket. At 18, Malia beckoned. You what, play through the speakers. This one's for the ravers and skankers. It was almighty sessions. Think less naughty geezers, think more in between us. And there was always beef between us as we danced off with me and him in the club for the supposed attention of the shot girl. And he couldn't dance for shit, and I can dance quite well, but the boys all took his side and said he won, and I just thought, bloody hell. We never did get anywhere with that girl. After we both bought her about 47 shots and she took our money and even quicker fucked off, we proceeded to dust ourselves down and we quickly forgot. Carried on parting the night away in our 3-coloured collared top man tops. At 18 years, 11 months and 8 days, I had to watch as my favourite enemy and my best mate passed away. The saddest of days in the worst of ways. Lung cancer's no way to go out of that age, but you know what's strange? As I sat beside him, him fading away, I told him that he'd be here with me every single day. I saw something in his eyes change, and for a brief second he was back. He stood up, shook my hand, made me a man, and then he sat, never to get up again. I guess he did want to give me that sort of satisfaction, cementing our friendship with his last action. That was the true measure of the man, and how much he still means, and I'll hold forever a special place in his heart and the electric of the fruit machines. At 28, and 10 years since you've been gone, we carry on having a football tournament once a year to remember you on, filled with Foster's football and fun. And what a great ode to your memory. Community has become your legacy. So this one's to you, Mako, our best mate and forever my favourite enemy. So I lost my best friend when we were both 18. We went to school together, so we've known each other since we were 5. Everyone says, like, oh, when a person goes, everyone says, oh, they're the nicest person in the world. And he was, but he was stubborn. He was argumentative. We had a relationship like brothers more so. We argued probably 96% of the time. Because, yeah, he was just a Tottenham fan, I was an Arsenal fan. If you can imagine that, and that's literally everything. That's our relationship to a T. I think the worst thing about losing him was the fact that we just became men. Like, we were 16 going on 17, then 18, and we were right at that age where actually, like, we were becoming men. We were about to embark on a different type of life, and he missed out on it all. So my memories are quite childlike to a degree. It's just having banter in school, having banter outside of school, walking to the chicken shop every night and fighting over the fruit machines. we used to go to poker on a Tuesday night in Riley's with fake ID, and his one looked more like me and mine looked more like him, but we never swap because we never help each other out. So even when we used to go to an under 18 pub, well, it was a pub, but we were under 18 when we went there, a place in Harrow called Oscar's, it's not there anymore, and we used to go there 7 o'clock every single Friday from 17 to 18 years old. We were in there before, like, the bouncers, before the barman, before anyone. We were just sitting there like lemons. And then the barmaids would come in, we'd start ordering drinks. They were like, can we see your ID? And, like, legitimately did not look like us at all. His one looked exactly like me. He was ginger. Mine was the other... mine looked more like him, a bit, like, blonde and a bit round-faced. But we never swapped, just chose to argue about it. And that was sort of the backdrop of our friendship throughout everything. So we're the best of mates, but we probably hated each other more than anybody, if that makes sense. The real sad thing is, I know exactly what type of man he would have became, and probably to the point where he'd be saying, what are you doing today? And I'd be like, a podcast. He'd be like, you're a weirdo. Like, that's the type of bloke he would be. We had one boys' holiday. We went to Malia. There was about, I think, about 18 of us in total. And we had that boys' holiday, which was amazing. We came back and he wasn't feeling too well, and then... end up being in hospital and they thought he had pneumonia. He came out of hospital, then 6 weeks later he ended up going back in and he got diagnosed with lung cancer. The person who I lost, his name was Sean McCormack, Macko for short, best friend since we were 5 years old. He passed away, sadly, just before his 19th birthday. I think I was sort of a bit naive because I think I was probably one of the only people that, until the day before he died, I thought he was going to survive. Yeah. I think the other people around me were a bit more clever, and not clever, but a bit more switched on with what was happening. But I always believed. I just felt like he was always going to survive. And I think it was only the day before he passed away. I worked in a shop selling like carpets and flooring. And across from us, we had a hospice. And I got a phone call from our mutual friend's father saying, Sean's gone into the hospice that's across the road from where you work. And it was only at that point there I was like, I knew what a hospice meant, and I was obviously just distraught. So I went and saw him that night, and I sat with his mum and him and me. It was only us three in the room. And even then, like, we were trying to crack a bit of banter, but the cancer was quite bad, so it had taken his, like, throat, so he couldn't speak very well. So it was only then that I realised what was about to happen. So at the time, being just turning 19 as such, I think it sent me on a bit of a spiral where, not like I was out of control, because our friendship group, with so many of us,
yeah,
our families, our community.
You had a close-knit community.
1,000%. So everyone was together. There was like, the night he passed away, or the day he passed away, the night we all went to the Duck in the Pond pub, and there was probably 120 people there, all together, all crying the same in unison. That's what he managed to do, was bring a community all together, and that's remained till even now. We were there when he passed away. We were all in the same room as him. The last thing he ever did before he died is I sat with him. His mum said, Danny, have a chat with him, like, say goodbye. So obviously it's heartbreaking. And I said, whispered in his ear, I said, Macko, mate, I love you. He actually stood up and shook my hand and then sat back down and then never got up again. Thank God he did that for me, because it shaped my life. In his last moment, he showed me something. Like, he gave me the best moment of my life in a really perverse way.
Yeah. Like,
that's probably the proudest I've ever been of myself and of someone. It was that moment where he got up and shook my hand.
Yeah.
So luckily he gave me that. I think otherwise I would have been worse. We had the moment there, then we had to go home, and I just remember going to the park. I didn't want to be with anyone. I went to the shop, bought like 4 or 5 beers, downed them, because I just didn't know what else to do. I just needed to do something. Walked to the park, and I just started crying my eyes out, to the point where I passed out. Like, there is horrible things. There's no way in the world that someone at his age should ever pass away.
Absolutely not.
Especially not of lung cancer at 18. It's like 1 in 8 million people can get what he got. Grief has to have a resolution. So you have to resolve it in your own head of, what do I gain from that? Mm-hmm. So the way to deal with grief is to make it a lesson. Mm-hmm. And the lesson that I've made out of Macko's passing is, he allowed other people to become better friends because we all became, brought us all together, and maybe his passing saved somebody else, possibly in like the just the karma of the world, maybe. To be honest, I kind of think I always wrote in my head, but I did start writing when he passed away, so back in 2009, 2010, but I don't have any mates that are cool, so in terms of creative,
yeah.
So I didn't really have anywhere to put it, so I just kind of used to write it or voice record it on my phone and then just do nothing with it. And then Facebook created this thing called Notes. Do you remember them back in the day?
Yeah, I do remember Notes, yeah.
And I was going through a breakup at the time, so I just put all my like love notes on Facebook. Oh my god, I'm not going to cry in this episode. But I'm going to cry over myself being so embarrassing. So I put notes up about like different things but I never spoke about him on them notes because I didn't want to be at the time. I felt attention seeking about it, if I'm honest. So I never. I don't get me wrong, I do still do like Facebook statuses like Mako gone but not forgotten, all that kind of stuff. But and probably a little bit for likes and a bit of attention as well. But I couldn't write about it, and I don't know why, but I just didn't feel comfortable speaking on it. I don't think it's because I didn't have much to say.
Mm-hmm.
The first poem actually I ever really did was for his funeral. So that was, I did speak on him once at his funeral, and I did a big poem. Which I wrote myself at 5 in the morning of the funeral, and I performed it. And to be fair, it's probably the best work I ever did. It's sitting at home somewhere. I need to get it out. But I did that there at the funeral, so in front of everybody, and we brought his coffin in, and then I stood up in front of it and did it. And like that was probably the second proudest moment of my life, apart from the handshake that he gave me. With my poetry, what has happened is that I can use empathy to create poetry. So some of the stories that I talk about might not be mine. Like I have one about being a busker called the District Line Busker, where I'm talking about being one of the homeless people that come on the train and ask people for money.
Yeah.
But I can, not that I can relate to that, and I will never try and say, oh yeah, I understand what it feels like. I don't. But I can just see a story from their point of view, or I think I can articulate it reasonably well enough to not be condescending or not be like patronizing to somebody's plight, because that, and I think that's maybe that's a skill that I personally have anyway, but
well, because you never know what they're going through, right?
Yeah, you don't know, but I think I can sort of get the feeling of stories.
Yeah.
So I talk on poetry about domestic abuse, or I talk about, they might not be lived experiences as such sometimes, but I think I can use the fact that I've gone through something to empathise with people's situations and maybe create reasonably good material out of the back of it. And that's what I want to continue to do.
You just listened to episode 4 of When Someone Great Is Gone. When Someone Great Is Gone is a podcast powered by Transmission Roundhouse, presented by Izzy Lee Poulton and co-produced by Bridie Addison Child. A special thanks to James Tyndale for additional editing on the podcast, and to Marie and Nikki from The Roundhouse for facilitating this project.